The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio. Hello, everyone. This is Jack Wilson. Today on the History of Literature, we are pleased to present a special guest episode. This comes from the podcast Overdue, which is hosted by Andrew and Craig. Today, in this episode, they are looking at The Graduate by Charles Webb. Now, you might know the book. It's much more likely that you will know the movie, with Dustin Hoffman and directed by Mike Nichols, with music by Simon and Garfunkel, who were then at their peak. It is one of my favorite movies. I've probably seen it 20 times. AFI, the American Film Institute, listed The Graduate as number 17 on its list of the greatest American movies of the first 100 years of movies. Number 9 on its list of greatest American comedies in that time period, but I like it better than any of the other comedies that are above it on that list. Sometimes movies just hit a sweet spot. Well, The Graduate does that for me. Highly rewatchable and highly recommended. Okay, enough about me, except to say that in spite of my love for The Graduate, I've never read the book. And so we have Andrew and Craig of the Overdue podcast, which you can find on your podcast app or at overduepodcast.com. It's all one word, Overdue Podcast. These guys are here to deliver the goods and to give you listeners a chance to hear what their podcast is all about. The Graduate, the novella by Charles Webb. What's it like? And is it like the movie at all? I'm looking forward to listening. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor, and their delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup, and you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts.
This is a HeadGum Podcast.
While Andrew and Craig believe the joy of discovery is crucial to enjoying any well-told tale, they will not shy away from spoiling specific story beats when necessary. Plus, these are books you should have read by now.
Hello, darkness, my old. old friends. Do something in again. Sleeping. I know all the words to this song.
Sing some more after I tell them that. Welcome to Overdue. It's a podcast about the books you've been meaning to read. My name is Craig.
My name's Andrew. I'm actually not going to sing any more words to the song. You guys got to go look it up. But after every podcast we record, I want you all at home to imagine Craig and I like at the end of The Graduate, where we turn off the record button and we're really happy for a minute, and then our faces fade to blankness as we consider the magnitude of what we have just done.
Oh, wonderful. Yes. we do that every week.
Every week for
honest.
Like 400 whatever episodes.
So if you've never listened before, that'll make perfect sense to you. One of us reads a book and tells the other person about it. Ostensibly, we might find out why a book is well known. Sometimes we're just going to find out what we think of the book, and sometimes we find out both. I think we might actually get both of those on this here episode today.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I want to ask you about your experience with the film, Andrew, but first, let me say that this book, The Graduate by Charles Webb, was recommended to us by one of our Patreon supporters, patreon.com/overduepod. CL said, while this may be an odd choice, I'd like to request Charles Webb's novel, The Graduate. As you would assume, this novel is the basis for the 1967 film of the same name. I would assume that. Both followed the same story, almost word for word. In any case, I thought that the abstract dialogue, resonating themes, and one's tendency to compare it to a film of such magnitude might make for an interesting discussion. The punctuation often infuriated me, and the dialogue became repetitive quite quickly. But perhaps one of you has something more eloquent to say about it. And then CL says nice things about our show, which I don't need to repeat.
That's on you to be the one who's got something interesting to say about it, I guess, and I'll just be along for the ride.
You can have opinions about my opinions. That's how the show works.
That's true. It is. I don't actually... So I've seen scenes from the movie. I've never sat down to watch the whole movie of this movie.
Interesting. Why and how have you seen scenes? Like,
part of it was... I mean, part of it's just like cultural osmosis. Like, I think the thing I just referenced with them getting on the bus at the end of the movie has been referenced a lot of times. Anytime anybody is staring into the middle distance while the song Hello Darkness, My Old Friend plays, that's a reference to The Graduate.
Sure.
And then, just whenever my dad would have like AMC on or whatever, like I'd catch bits and bobs of things.
Oh, sure. Yes.
I've seen like the scene with the leg.
Oh, the leg.
Mrs. Robinson, are you trying to seduce me? I saw, like, I remember at the beginning where he's, like, in a pool having ennui.
There's a lot of pool ennui. My only reference, I think I probably have, like, weaker versions of your reference points just from, like, The Simpsons and stuff or whatever. But I do remember that the end of Wayne's World 2 is, like, a full-on parody of the end of The Graduate. Complete with him and like some, he bars a door with, instead of a crucifix, he uses a guitar and stuff. Of course, it's not Wayne's World 1.
Okay, Wayne's World 2, 1993. So really topical reference then to The Graduate, which came out in 1967.
I think at that point it was like one of the, it's every Wayne or, you know, Mike Myers, is that who it is? Could presume that most people watching would get it. Which is
sure.
Not that it was like, oh, let me make fun of the hit film that just came out. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I don't really know anything about it. I think I was trying to remember. I think I saw a play adaptation of this in college in a student production that I forgot everything about. Like,
okay,
the play has not been reviewed particularly well. And I don't want to speak ill of anyone I went to college with, but I don't remember the production at all. But what can you tell me about Mr. Webb before we get into the book proper?
I can tell you that he led a singular life.
Okay.
So Charles Webb was born in 1939 and died just this year, June of 2020.
Sure.
And he was a big advocate of a non-materialist lifestyle. So he was sort of born into money. I know his dad was a doctor, but he renounced most of that, like, throughout his entire life. He, like, refused his inheritance. he and his wife sold multiple homes that they owned. Like, they were just kind of shedding possessions one by one, and they, and that was kind of how they lived their life. Like, he sold the film rights to The Graduate. The book came out in 1963. He sold the film rights for a flat fee of $20,000, which, given the smash hit success of the film, is not very much money.
Yep.
He like gave away a bunch of like Andy Warhol art that they owned. For a while, he was trying to homeschool his kids, and that literally was illegal at the time. So they were just kind of driving around in a VW microbus.
Yeah.
Which is the ultimate hippie thing.
Sure.
Yeah, he and his wife, Ava, who later went by Fred in reference to a group named Fred, which was targeted at men with low self-esteem, according to an obituary from the New York Times that I read. They married in 1962, divorced in 1981, but not because of estrangement. It was to protest the institution of marriage and the fact that same-sex marriage was not legal at the time. And then in 2001, they remarried for immigration purposes. He lived in, I think, Britain.
Yeah, they moved to England.
Yeah.
One of them over there. Mm-hmm. I know they had two kids, one of whom was a performance artist who reportedly ate a copy of the book with cranberry sauce.
Yeah, and then the other son works at a consulting firm. So, yeah, different. We all rebel against our parents in different ways.
Takes some all kinds.
Some of us eat their greatest work, and some of us reject their rejection of materialism. There's some speculation, adamantly denied by all parties, of course, that Fred's mother was the inspiration for Mrs. Robinson, though he has gone on record as saying it was the friend of one of his father's like work colleagues.
Yeah.
This is from a piece in The Guardian I read. Mrs. Robinson was an aberrant fantasy of mine that popped out. I was at home after college, like the character in the film. My father was a doctor and had couples over to the house to play bridge. There was a wife of one of the doctors who came over, and at the sight of her, my fantasy life became supercharged. I can't imagine what that's a euphemism for. I went to the Pasadena Library one day and wrote a short plot outline to get that person out of my system. My purpose in writing has always been to work things out of me. Later, I got a grant from my college to turn it into a novel.
Yeah.
That's a reference to it, like a 2-year grant that he got, despite being an otherwise mediocre student.
Huh.
Yeah. So, yeah, the book came out in 63. It came out of that encounter with his dad's work friend's wife, I guess,
sure,
and a 2-year grant. It was reviewed in the Times sort of mediocrely at the time. The reviewer called it, quote, a fictional failure.
Whoa.
But did think the protagonist was better than Holden Caulfield, which low bar there. Holden Caulfield sucks.
There's some Caulfield vibes to this work. If you come at it with that as a reference point, it's doing a lot of different things, but I don't think that inherent melancholia and ennui is not a bad place to start.
Yeah. So Webb wrote a total of 8 books during his life, with a big gap in the 80s and 90s. There was a sequel to The Graduate floating around for a while in the 90s called Gwen that was never published. There was another sequel that was published in 2007 called Homeschool that was only published to pay off debt, according to his obituary. And yeah, he mostly seems like he's found especially the film's success, kind of a distraction. Like he thinks it distracts from his artistry and his more serious work, which I can't speak for anybody, because I've never written anything that's turned into an international hit success film that overshadows everything that I will do for the rest of my life. So I honestly don't know what my relationship to that kind of work would be like, but it does seem like the film, as adaptations go, is pretty straightforward, especially in a lot of its dialogue.
And the book lends itself to that. The book is no internal monologue. There is no people do things in the book, but they
sure
often,
that's a lot of books.
But they he like never that. Describes like how they're feeling about them while they're doing it. There's all and there's a lot of just pages of dialogue with nothing but quotation marks, just going back and forth like a play almost.
So are you?
It's not formatted like a play, but it does feel like one in the sense that like it's very detached. You might get like he untucks his shirt or he sat down and pulled on the lobe of his ear, but you don't get like and he was thinking of blah 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 blah.
Right. So as a reader, are you supposed to be reading stuff into that? Is it supposed to come off as a like an external sign of these characters, like emotional dissatisfaction and detachment? Like how are we supposed to interpret that?
My read on it is it accomplishes a bunch of different things. I bet for him, there's an emotional detachment among most of the characters that I think he's going for, but also that might just be his style. Like he was interested in what they were saying to each other. So it allows you for a certain to like read with an ear towards the subtext of it, and a lot of the book is driven by people kind of talking themselves in and out of circles, and then maybe like crying about it, and then saying something to get someone to stop crying. but it has an effect for me of really playing into this. Detached, ennui-laden protagonist, quote-unquote protagonist, I guess. He's the main character anyway. And it also makes his eventual love interest, Elaine, a real nothing of a character, which is probably my biggest issue with the book.
Uh-huh.
And I read a few... I was browsing some like retrospectives on the film, and even folks' appraisals and reappraisals of the film seem to... suggest that Elaine, I don't remember who plays her in the movie.
I had this pulled up.
Okay.
We've got Anne Bancroft, Dustin Hoffman, and Catherine Ross.
Catherine Ross as Elaine.
In the film.
Just that character is also a passive, like nothing person for a lot of viewers. And that is certainly the case in the book, at least for me reading it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's there's a lot said when you read about this book about how it sort of predicts some of the like cultural upheaval of the later 1960s. And I guess I'm curious to know how that comes through or like how you feel about that or even what your relationship to other works that depict that or came out of that era.
Ooh,
are.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a thought about that. I think the book, so it was written in 63, right? It gets made into a movie in 67.
Yes.
It really feels like it's set in the 50s. Like it feels like the first season of Mad Men, not the other, which I know is in 1960, not the other seasons.
The first couple years of any decade are they technically belong to the previous decade.
Yeah. And so this book is. And it's also very personal, so it like elements of it obviously inspired by the time he saw a friend of his dad's sort of naked, I guess. But
you
also
really didn't have to. You really didn't have to have much to get inspired to write a book sometimes.
but also his relationship with Elaine and like her family, not Elaine, Ava is his wife's name, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean Fred.
I don't remember if yeah, okay.
Fred and,
thank you. Yeah. Their relationship did not start with like her parents approving of them, and I think she may have gotten pregnant and had an abortion which her family didn't approve of, and they ultimately get together and are married before this book comes out. So there's an element to the autobiographical underpinnings of the story of this like jaded graduates, you know, literally moving into the world. And the book is written with him having already gotten the girl. And so there's this like, I don't know, it's really wrapped up in his personal experience, which means it's closed off from, for me, closed off from what you expect a book set in the 60s might be talking about in terms of, like, it's written before we're going to be start talking about Vietnam. Like, we're not talking about the civil rights movement. We're not talking about that era of the women's movement, like the women's rights movement. Like, it just is really wrapped up in a particular portrait of a guy doesn't like how his rich family makes him feel.
Mm-hmm.
An older woman who doesn't like her lot in life because she has been trapped in a marriage and her wealth kind of traps her from, and her dependence on her husband's wealth traps her from doing anything. And now she's
you can just say that she is a woman in any era of history, in any place on the planet Earth.
Well, specific to this moment, she is watching her, you know, she dropped out of college, Mrs. Robinson. You find this out later in the book. Mrs. Robinson dropped out of college, I think, when she got pregnant and then got married, and now is watching her daughter go off to college at Berkeley and is like, I'm just going to be stuck here and the world's going to pass me by.
This is what I might have wanted for myself, but I can't. It's too late for me now.
So, and I think that is what makes her a compelling character, and certainly has made the film version of her character stand out. But it's like, I don't know, it's the version of the mid-20th century novel that is not, to me, not about the larger political upheavals of that era, but is about, like, I don't know how I feel about what society wants me to be.
Yeah,
and I put like on a whiny voice only because I feel like it's tropey at this point, and I have no idea what it would be like to read this book in the 60s and be like, that's me! I feel that way!
Well, or, so, like, what's happened in, like, American society at this point? Like, the post-war, I guess, feel-good America rah-rah period is sort of dissipated, like the era of Ike's steady and sort of I don't know how to accurately describe the Eisenhower presidency, but it's not like, it is not a period of marked upheaval in American history.
Nope. And this book is being like outlined while JFK is getting elected, you know, like,
yeah, and it's like the boomers are beginning to come into adulthood.
Yes.
Which, that's been fun for all of the rest of us this entire time.
Which I guess is sort of what this is about. Like, I guess Benjamin being 21 in 1963-ish, it's not quite a boomer, but it's really close. It's probably like a edge case. I don't know how astrology works, like rising boomer.
He's like an old lost generation. I don't know. What's the one in between?
Is it greatest or is it silent?
Oh, yeah, the greatest. Yeah. No, I don't
know these
anymore.
Somebody
who was 21 in 1963 would be counted among the greatest generation.
No. Well, and I don't think
Benjamin. He didn't kill any Nazis.
That's true. And Benjamin certainly doesn't feel like he's a part of any great generation. He probably thinks it's all bogus. Well, let's get into the book and we can maybe tease apart some of this other stuff as we unpack how the book works and goes. I put a little poem here at the top of my notes here, Andrew. I said, this is the story all about how a life got flipped, turned upside down. I'd like to take a minute, just go on and sit. I'll tell you how our mom slept with a recent graduate. Benjamin Braddock graduated from a small but prestigious Eastern college. He's received some sort of teaching prize, as well as multiple offers to either continue his education at fancy schools or to teach at Eastern colleges, which he says multiple times as a lad in California. And he's simultaneously boasting and being like, those suckers will hire me anywhere because I got job offers at Eastern colleges, whatever that means.
Sorry, I'm still mad about that thing that you did.
That's okay. I didn't like prepare you for it. I just prepared it for us. And the book opens on a party that his parents are throwing for him, a graduation party for him. He's come home from the East Coast. He's at his parents' rich house with his parents' rich friends. I thankfully can't think of an experience as a young or recent adult where I've had to go to one of these parties growing up. And I don't envy Ben in this instance. I know this, like, this seen as a trope in fiction, but I personally don't have experience with that, like, painful, here's all my
parents' weird friends that I need to talk to, and they won't let me alone.
I feel like I've, like, I don't know, like, maybe like an anniversary party or something would be a time where you'd do that sort of thing as an adult, but if we're just, like, middle class Andrew and Craig.
That's true.
Like everybody calls us when we ride the train from Scranton to Philadelphia every day.
Every day to work.
Every day. It's just, like fancy cotillions or whatever. That's not something we do.
No, that's true.
We don't have to impress our parents' friends at a party as adults very often.
Thank God. I don't even know what I would do. Mm. And Benjamin hates it also. He doesn't want to leave his room. He doesn't want to give Mr. Robinson a ride in his fancy new car, which his dad keeps telling him to do. And there's just a montage of him trying to leave this party so he can go for a walk. And the adults keep...
That I have experienced.
The adults keep coming up to him and being like, oh man, what are you going to do now that you graduated? You were real amazing in school, huh? One guy walks up to him, grabs his hand, and just says, how the hell are you? Which is the most like adult talking to waspy, a new adult wasp thing. And he gets in a fight with his dad about how this whole party is grotesque. And there are no other people his age. Benjamin goes through this entire book. The only other person of consequence his own age that he interacts with is Elaine Robinson, the daughter of the family. Mm-hmm. There's no other... no other people in his generation that he has any bonds with. And I don't know what that says. I don't know what that accomplishes from Webb's perspective. If it means that Benjamin is like uniquely isolated, is that how Webb thinks everyone in that generation feels? I am still thinking about it because I don't have an answer for like why Benjamin is hermetically sealed off from all the people he went to college with. Like, did he become a Holden Caulfield at college and everyone's a phony to him now, or what happened? I don't think the book properly the book is uninterested in explaining that. It just is.
Sure.
And he doesn't like the party. He comes back up to his room and Mrs. Robinson is there.
Ooh.
And she asks him for a ride home. I don't believe that she can drive or does not know how. I'm not sure. And she invites him in for a drink and she puts on some tunes and she's going real hard with the like, well, you know me, I'm a friend of your parents. Don't you have an opinion of me? I can't do like, I haven't seen the scene. I don't know how Anne Bancroft does it, but, and this, I was reading this book. I think I messaged you at the time. This book gets to the part that, like, if you've ever heard of the movie, is like the beginning.
Yeah,
real quick.
Yes, that is my memory of the movie as well. Is that leg in those pantyhose is out like real fast?
Yes, like
there's not a lot of building to it, which I guess it's less of a thing that's built to and more of an inciting action. I guess.
I guess coming in, I don't think I truly understood that this relationship kicked off the novel in the way that it does.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a thing when characters like this get like kind of have an outsized cultural impact as kind of a thing that lives beyond just the source text. So this is a thing. I did watch how Dustin Hoffman delivers the line. You're trying to seduce Mrs. Robinson. You're trying to seduce me, aren't you? And he does do a very good job with that line. There is a period after you're trying to seduce me and then a beat. And then he goes, aren't you? And it's a very, it's very well done because that whole scene, and it plays this way in the book, he is trying to navigate it, but he doesn't really know what he wants and he doesn't know what she wants. And it's scary to him. She seems to know exactly what she wants. She even says to him, if you won't sleep with me this time, I want you to know you can call me up anytime you want and we'll make some kind of arrangement. and Mr. Robinson does come home, doesn't catch them doing anything. And he's like, hey, when my daughter comes home from school, why don't you call her up? She's going to be home in a little bit. That doesn't happen. She stays at summer school. So then he spends his summer,
Oh, first, do you remember, have you ever seen a part of this movie where he gets a diving suit for his birthday and his dad forces him to demonstrate it in the pool in front of everyone?
This sounds familiar to me now that you mention it.
It's embarrassing and awful. It's like a really demented version of that scene in The Christmas Story where they make the kid put on the pink bunny suit and he's like crying about it. Do you just laugh because that's funny to you?
Yeah, no, that's funny. It's funny. It's a funny scene. It's a funny movie.
I haven't
Bumpus Dogs, man.
That's a good,
every year, give them to me.
Not a bad movie, to be honest.
Susanna doesn't love it, but it's because she didn't watch it until like 3 years ago. And she finds the sort of vignette-ness of it sort of off-putting instead of
And there's like kind of a meanness. Iconic. There's a meanness to a lot of those stories on purpose that I think is like it's a little boy thing.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly a trope of a little boy thing. But there's this really awkward, awful party. And maybe it's Benjamin's dad like being mad about the graduation party, but he's like, put on the diving suit and get in the pool and demonstrate it to everybody. And like, he can't actually get to the bottom of the pool because he's wearing a compression tank.
Yeah.
And so he's just flopping around in the pool and everyone starts booing and laughing at him. And at one point he makes him hold like a cinder block and sit on the bottom of the pool. And the chapter just ends with him like under the water going, Dad, and it's really like, what?
That's a bit over the top.
It is a bit over the top. He spends several weeks, and I was kind of surprised that the book didn't show any of this. He goes away for a few weeks, like bumming on the road, doing odd jobs. He fights a wildfire for some reason. He says he hired some sex workers, but maybe that's not true. Maybe he just says that to make his mom uncomfortable. Unclear. And when he comes back, his parents are talking to him. And this line got me. They say, you sound kind of disillusioned about things. Which is...
I have nothing to...
It's kind of... I don't know. That was one of the like 10 moments in the book where I was like, oh, I've been reading books inspired by fiction like this for way longer than I can recall. Like, this type of, I guess, what is our version of, like, what's a book or a movie that you can think of that's like, everything, life's not even, like, why would you even do it, man? Like, I don't even know what to do with my... I'm thinking like the movie Garden State, but I don't know that I feel good about
that
reference.
Movie Garden State's a little like that. I mean, like, I feel like any number of Kevin Smith movies is probably, you know, the View Askewniverse.
I hate that it's called that.
But yeah, like your Mallrats is...
Sure.
Is kind of like, that's a little... further back, like you and I would have been like 9 when that movie came
out.
Yeah. But I don't know. Did you have something
that was it was just Garden State, which again I don't feel great about as an option.
Juno.
Well, because like I look back,
Little Miss Sunshine.
There's like Reality Bites, and before that, there's The Breakfast Club a little bit too. Mm-hmm. But this has like a particular...
Just like movies that sum up the teen experience in a way where you get embarrassed about it when you try to watch those movies as an adult.
Yeah, a little bit.
Sure.
A little bit. And also movies where central characters are really disillusioned with their current options and what they think the future might hold.
The Scott Pilgrim movie.
Is that what that's about? I thought it was about video games.
I mean, it's about a lot of things. It's very deep work. But
a very rich text.
Mostly it's about a white boy who's kind of sad about some things.
Hey, that's what this book's about. So checks out. Perfect comparison. Mm-hmm. He does embark on an affair with Mrs. Robinson because he comes back from his trip. He's still bored and sad. And he goes to the Taft Hotel with Mrs. Robinson. They start an affair. It's really awkward. He tries to ask her, like, maybe we should go to a movie first, and she laughs at him and basically coerces him into having sex with him by, like, being like, are you a virgin? Oh, you're just a virgin, aren't you? You don't need to be embarrassed. And he's like, stop it. We're going to have an affair right now. And
that is how that begins. It goes on for a period of time. He has foregone his teaching prize. He is, it's now like the fall and he can't go back to school for that anymore. So he's just like sitting in his parents' house, drinking, laying in the pool, having sex with Mrs. Robinson sometimes, and watching TV, which, like, you know, that's a way to spend some time.
Yeah.
He gets in a fight about his with his dad about being their ivy-covered status symbol. Again, I don't know that I can identify with the parents treating you like a prize thing, but that does seem to be a very specific feeling that Charles Webb had.
I'm trying to, like, I definitely would, like, if Henry were good at something, or even if he were just, like, doing something, I would be interested in having other people in my life who I love to see that thing.
Yeah.
So I could be the proud papa, but I wouldn't, like, make him if he didn't want to. Or I don't know. I wouldn't go out of my way to humiliate him in calling attention to whatever thing it is that he's doing.
I would like to think that's true, and I believe you will accomplish it. I think we don't know what he will feel as embarrassing.
Yeah,
but that's a separate issue.
Yes, but I don't know. I feel pretty confident in saying that if it borders on child abuse, there's not much of a chance that I will.
I think that is definitely true.
That I will do it.
And the way it's presented by Benjamin and his understanding is that, like, his dad is, like, you know, proving to his friends that he sent his son to this Ivy, you know, to this really prestigious school, and now he has qualified for Ivy League graduate school if he wants it, and, like, look at how good of a son I made is basically Benjamin's read on the situation, which he feels bad about. And so he's like, whatever, I'm just going to sleep with this lady that you think is a mess. And it builds up to pressure from Mr. Robinson being like, hey, you should take my daughter out when she comes home. Like, that would be a cool thing. She's going to come home for the winter break or whatever. Like, you should really take her out because that would be a good match. Be dope if you did that. And Mrs. Robinson is like, don't you talk to her. I will go scorched earth on you if you talk to my daughter and take her out on a date.
Mm-hmm.
He does take her on a date.
Uh-oh.
Andrew, what's the worst place you've ever thought to take someone on a date?
Ooh,
I don't know that I have an answer to this myself. I saw a John Cusack movie once that I regret.
Star Trek Nemesis on a date.
Okay.
When Susanna and I lived in Mount Vernon,
well, that's a lot.
We saw a lot of bad movies on dates. We saw a lot of
bad
But
those
movies
weren't
on
first
dates.
Dates.
No, those were like established.
You're
like,
trapped.
The
dates.
Way I feel about you will not be affected by the quality of the movie we're about to watch dates.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Well,
I did go on a date where we went to a Chinese buffet, and then I locked us out of my car, and then an old lady who had AAA had us sit in her car while we waited for AAA to get there.
That's good.
Yeah.
That was a fun conversation.
But that was a story, though. Like,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you got to tell that later.
Yeah. Like, even at the time, I was like, dang, this is a story.
We're living in a story. That's cool.
Living in a storybook. Yeah.
Benjamin takes Elaine to a strip club. Like, they go to one club.
That is not a great, well, that's not a good move. I would say.
Go to one club and there's dancing and they start drinking and they get bored and they go to another club that has a strip show. Maybe there's other things at this club. Unclear. It's not a great first date. They end up getting seated right by the stage. Elaine can't even face the show. She really hates it. The dancer starts spinning her boob tassels in Elaine's face to the point that Elaine starts crying. And that's when Benjamin's like, yeah, this club, we gotta leave. We have to leave because I made my girlfriend cry because the stripper put her boobs in her face. Great first date.
Ain't that always, whomst among us has not experienced this, you know?
Yes. They make up over hamburgers at a drive-in restaurant. It's very unclear to me, because we have no access to the characters' inner lives, why this is like a successful turning point for them. Maybe in the film it's a little like you can pick up on some clues.
Things.
Yeah. Sure. And then they go to, he tries to drop her off her house. She is like, why don't you come in? He's like, no. She's like, well, let's go to a bar. There's a bar at that hotel. And Benjamin's like, well, okay, let's go. And everyone at the hotel is like treating him like he comes in there all the time, because he does with Elaine's mom. And she's like, oh, are you having an affair with someone? And he's like, yes, I am sleeping with a woman. But it's because we were both bored, and it, like, it's not a big thing. And now you know my secret, and you still want to go out on a date tomorrow? And she's like, yeah. And I think that is the moment when he's like, wow, I love this chick. When she's like, oh, well, I understand that you had a relationship with an older woman who was married, but let's go out on a date tomorrow.
And also, let's not discuss, let's not have any follow-up questions.
None, please, none. because the next day, he tries to pick her up for that date, and Mrs. Robinson goes, like, thermonuclear and blows their cover. Basically says, like, you can't take her out on the date, and he runs up to her bedroom to try to convince her to leave. And Mrs. Robinson comes in, and Elaine picks up on the signals and tells Benjamin to get out.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Here's the weirdest page break that follows that scene, Andrew. For several weeks, Benjamin stayed at home. Sometimes he would go out by the pool and look down on the water, and sometimes he would walk slowly around the block. But usually he sat in his room, staring down at the rug or looking out through the window at some wires he could see running along beside the street on telephone poles. Then after he had been home for nearly a month and Christmas had passed and the new year had started, he decided to marry Elaine. Yep, makes perfect sense.
Yeah, no, that follows. That tracks.
And this is where the movie kind of, not the movie, the book goes off the rails for me a little bit.
The
book
is like a movie that you read.
Shove words in your head and understand.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a movie, but on paper.
It's like a stilly.
That's what they call them. That's what they used to call them.
It don't move. It's just printed on the page.
Yeah, because, well, the word movie was there, and they were like, well, what do we call this new thing?
Yeah.
Definitely. He follows her to Berkeley and goes full on, like,
why did we stop calling them talkies? I really feel like we still need to distinguish them from the silent films. So ones that move are movies, but ones with sound are talkies.
Andrew, there's
still
nothing stopping you and me from calling them talkies from here on out.
We can't do that. And I bet we can get some statistically significant portion of our listenership to start calling them talkies.
This is how cultural movements are born.
That's true. Yeah, just ask Charles Webb.
He spent his lifetime running from his legacy, and we're going to spend our lifetimes running from ours.
Running toward it.
Yeah. he follows her to Berkeley, and it goes full on, like, stalker, notes from the underground, creepo land, where he moves into a flat across the street from her, like, dormitory. He sells his car so he has enough money to pay rent. He doesn't do anything except, like, sit in his room and walk around sometimes until he finally starts bumping into her. And over a series of, like, creepy interactions, like, one, he follows her to get on a bus to the zoo where she's already meeting someone else for a date. And then she is like, listen, we do need to talk. My mother said that you took her up to a hotel room while she was drunk and took advantage of her and then gaslit her into being in an affair with you. And he's like, no, 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 that didn't happen. I did sleep with your mom a bunch, though. And and after, and she basically is like, so you moved up to Berkeley for me after all this nonsense. What am I supposed to do with that? Which is like a very, that's like the most compelling thing about Elaine, is that she's like, I feel responsibility for you because of this terrible situation you've put me in.
Yeah.
It does cause her to, like, let him be in her life longer than she probably should, because she is like, well, listen, I can't just tell you to leave and fear that you're going to like go drink yourself to death in a ditch or something because I, you know, don't want anything to do with you, which is like, she could do that. And I would not be upset with her for that choice.
Okay.
But she doesn't feel like she can do that. And it leaves the door open for more interactions with him that ultimately end up with them like kissing and him saying maybe she'll marry him. And she's like, maybe.
Hmm.
And then speed run to the end. The parents do get involved. Her parents are going to get a divorce. His parents threaten to take him to a psychiatrist, which is a real 60s thing if I've ever heard.
In the 60s, that like your life is over. Especially if you're a man and people found out you had therapy, like, uh-oh.
Yeah, his dad comes up and is like, well, I'm taking you home. You have an appointment with a psychiatrist. And whoa. He's like, whoa, dad, did you bring a straitjacket with you? It's like, come on. It's
now it's like, we'll give you... we will comp you to do a remote therapy session so that your productivity doesn't suffer.
Yeah, we kind of looped around on that one.
We did too good of a job getting rid of the stigma. We should probably add some stigma back.
just maybe a little stigma as a treat.
Little stigma as a treat.
Oh my God. It just has that vibe of like, oh no, a shrink, the superego of society is going to eat me. Like I was reading this book thinking about One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest a little bit.
Oh,
not,
sure.
Not because Ratchet and Mrs. Robinson are similar in any like real way. But
beyond being like white ladies of a certain age, I guess.
Well, I think that they're characters that have become iconic for what they mean in their stories and outside of their stories.
Sure, okay.
And both of them are also related to like male anxieties about women in that era. So I don't know. I just found myself, and then the scene where it was like, oh no, a psychiatrist. I was like, oh great, Cuckoo's Nest, wonderful. Mm-hmm. And then it gets to the super fast wedding scene where Mr. Robinson has made this like shotgun wedding happen with Carl Smith, and lo and behold, the movie scene that you know, where he bursts into the church and he's up on the second floor, and then he punches a dude, and then they run away and get on a bus. Like that's just the book, like page for page. I just envisioned Wayne doing all of it in my head from Wayne's World.
From Wayne, okay, yes, sure.
Because I don't, you know, I know what Dustin Hoffman looks like, but I have not seen the film, so I don't.
I mean, you could just, there are many YouTube clips of the end of that movie. I in fact, watched one to prep for this.
Any insights?
No, it's just, it's pretty much as I remembered it.
But what you said at the top of the episode of them, it does end with them getting on a bus. She is technically married at that point. I think the ceremony has happened. And they get on the bus and she says, Benjamin, and he says, what? And then like, it's like the bus drives away or something. And that's the end of the book.
Yeah. Like in the movie, they don't speak to each other at all. It's all like,
just looks.
It is both like an occasional one-sided look, like they don't look at each other directly in that sequence. And then also everybody on the bus is looking at the weirdos who sprinted on, and one of them's in a wedding dress.
Yep.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting read. I'm kind of glad I read it.
Because everybody knows like the stuff about The Graduate, right? Like this is one of the big boys of literature, as they call them. And so could you sense why it had the impact that it had, or was it sort of a what was that book that we read with the librarian is in?
Oh, the Peyton's Place.
Yes, Peyton's Place. Did you know why it had been so influential, or was it a Peyton's Place thing where it seems kind of silly in retrospect?
It doesn't seem full on silly in retrospect. What actually struck me most about reading it is and hear what whatever review you said, calling it like fictional farts or whatever he called it,
a farce.
Is that
make
like
sure that's right?
Or a
fictional failure?
Okay,
failure.
Sure.
I knew it wasn't fictional farts.
But, you know.
Get out here with your fictional farts.
No one would have written that in the New York Times in the 60s.
Or now.
First time on New York Times. I get why the movie probably landed with this as source material. The I'm a recent college grad and I don't know what to do with my parents, and I don't know what to do with this life that feels increasingly preordained based on some choices I made when I was like, or choices that were made for me when I was 17 and I didn't really know what I wanted anyway. And a bunch of people were like, go here, do this. And I said, yes. Mm-hmm. That wrapped up in late 60s kind of burgeoning or already active counterculture stuff, I can, but like in a sanitized romantic comedy way, I can see that really clicking with people. I don't think all of that's in this book. I don't think the book is particularly funny, even though people describe the movie as a very successful comedy, because like watching him in those scenes with Mrs. Robinson can be comedic, or could be pretty comedic. So I think it straddles the generational stuff in an interesting way, as we were talking about before, where like, It is probably Charles Webb being like, I don't like this about how certain people function. It doesn't really make for me a lot of broader claims or broader sweeping claims. And I think a lot of books don't hold up to that scrutiny. Like the themes come 10 years after people have been reading the book and talking about it or thinking about the film adaptation or something like that.
Okay.
I do think, as I said earlier, so let me just read a little bit of an interaction between Benjamin and Mrs. Robinson. This is in kind of their fight where she reveals some of her backstory. They're kind of arguing about whether or not to go forward with the affair. It's kind of getting heated. He is telling her that she's making him sick with this whole thing. And she said, and this is like back and forth. Did you mean those things you said, Benjamin? You are damn right I did. I am sorry, she said. Well, I am too, but that's the way it is. That's how you feel about me, he nodded. That I'm a sick and disgusting person, she said, looking down at the rug. Benjamin finished tucking in his shirt tails, then looked at her. Now don't start this, he said. What? Don't start acting hurt. Don't you expect me to be a little hurt? And it goes on from there. Like, that's the rhythm of a lot of the dialogue. It's very, I'm not performing it effectively.
Yeah, no. It feels like the kind of, I get a little bit frustrated with dialogue like that, where sometimes I will lose track of who's supposed to be speaking.
Yes.
Because it's just like blah 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 blah, and it's like it's ping pong or a game of tennis as played at the Enfield Tennis Academy, just to pick an example. Yeah,
and it, sometimes the way it's formatted, I think CL, our patron, made an allusion to this. If he does include some, like, for lack of a better word, stage business, sometimes the next person's line will still be the previous person's person talking, but there wasn't a line. The line breaks get a little wonky. And at its best, it really allows for like an undercurrent of like thinking about intonation and thinking about subtext. At its worst, as I said, like, I have no idea why Elaine is remotely into this man. And like, the book has no language to explain that maybe it's because her parents have a terrible relationship and her mom's an alcoholic. And so like, someone who needs her but isn't her parents is attractive to her. There's no text for that in the book. I'm applying all of that. And I read some forums where people are like trying to figure out why this character might work. So,
okay.
There's a lot of different anxieties in the book that I think make Mrs. Robinson interesting. And so like, catching that character and trying to figure out why she is the way she is, and how she interacts with the other adults or doesn't, because it's kind of like, it's Benjamin, it's Mrs. Robinson, it's Elaine, and it's like the alliance of other crappy adults, like the world. That Mrs. Robinson is not a part of, nor is Benjamin. And Elaine, I think, is connected to other people at Berkeley and stuff like that. So it really is like Mrs. Robinson and Benjamin against the world in their own ways, which is maybe an explanation for how they find each other. But I'm glad I read it because I get where these characters come from now. But I certainly don't think that the book was going to become a thing on its own if not for that movie. Sure. That movie that had like this like big soundtrack that helps, you know, make Simon and Garfunkel even more popular. Mike Nichols's direction is apparently very well regarded in that film, and how things are shot and how it's directed. And it was released on December 21st of that year, which I know is like Oscar season, but also like a Christmas movie, maybe? It's not a Christmas movie. It's like I went and saw Titanic the weekend of Christmas when Titanic came out.
1967.
Yeah, what came out around that?
Christmas Kid is a Western that came out that year.
I have never seen a Christmas Western. Huh. Bonus episode.
There's a movie called Fitzwillie.
Perfect.
A butler helps finance his employer's charitable activities through a variety of illicit schemes, including a plan to rob Gimbel's department store on Christmas Eve. This is on the Wikipedia article, List of Christmas Films.
That seems like a prequel to Paul Blart
and
Robin Gimbel's.
Dick Van Dyke is Fitzwillie, I guess.
All right. Any Fitzwillie fans, get at us. Let us know.
Or don't.
Get at me, and I'll tell Andrew later.
Yeah, get at Craig.
Yeah.
And he can filter the good stuff.
Andrew, just my closing question for you. How do you think the Mrs. Robinson Benjamin thing would play out in the era of social media? What kind of navigations would have to be done? What kind of inappropriate things would get done?
Mostly one of them would have to be on an age inappropriate social media platform.
Ooh.
And I don't know if that means like Mrs. Robinson is on TikTok or if Benjamin is on Facebook.
I made a note that there might be a lot of inappropriate LinkedIn activity, but she wouldn't have a LinkedIn if she's a kept woman that way necessarily.
No, she probably wouldn't have a LinkedIn. I mean, she might have like an old LinkedIn that she hasn't updated in a long time. Yes. And then you see like her husband or daughter or something sees that she's updated her LinkedIn for the first time in a long time. You're like, I didn't think she had any new professional accomplishments. Why is she trying to get endorsed for adultery on LinkedIn? I don't understand.
What a cool skill. Yeah, I was just thinking about that, like how this type of relationship is also now a trope that reverberates back to this film and to this book. So thinking like they made a Jennifer Aniston movie
Jennifer Aniston,
they
was the sister of Jennifer Aniston.
Yes, they
I
made
assume.
A movie in 2005 or something that was like her called Rumor Has It, that is apparently the book The Graduate and the movie is in the fictional universe of that film, and her mother and grandmother might be the inspiration for the story. That's the plot of the movie. Mm-hmm. That her grandmom is Mrs. Robinson. Make a movie about it. Go. Like, that seems like the prompt for the money that they spent on that one. Rumor has it that movie exists.
I'm trying to think of like a rethinking of the Mrs. Robinson song that's about like sliding into the DMs. Yeah, think about that.
Think on that.
And we'll come back to it next time.
Yeah,
it's one to grow on.
And if anybody's going to read this book, they sound intrigued. Like, think, I guess, like a close read of it that might be interesting is like looking at the ways that Webb mentions education and teaching. That certainly is his axe to grind about like what the school system did or didn't do to him and what he thinks he needs to learn in life, as evidenced by his later text as well. And there's a lot of references to like, well, thanks, Mrs. Robinson. You've been really educational for me. You know what I mean?
The school of the heart. Oh, no.
That's it. We got to can't say that.
Well,
on air.
That's all the time we have.
That's all the time we have here today. If you want to let us know how you would update this movie for the social media age, or update the song Mrs. Robinson for the social media age, you can hit us up at overduepod@gmail.com or on social media, twitter.com and facebook.com/overduepod. Thanks to Becca, Fadina, Tabitha, Lexi, Eve, Kristen, Holly, Dion, many more for hitting us up over the course of this past week. Andrew, folks want to know more about the show, where should they go?
They should go to overduepodcast.com, which is our internet website. Up there we have links to Apple, Google, the RSS. We're also on Spotify and Stitcher. Subscribe however you want. Rate and review us on iTunes. Well, it's not iTunes anymore. It hasn't been called iTunes in several years, which I should be aware of as somebody who writes a like 20,000 word review of macOS every year.
Yep.
But yeah, do rate and review us, whatever it's called, the Apple one.
The Apple one.
Because it makes us feel good. Also, patreon.com/overduepod, which Craig mentioned at the top of the show. You can recommend books to us and they will get added to our queue. We do still have a backlog.
We'll keep reading them.
Yeah, and that's just, you know, honestly, that just encourages you to be a fan for longer. Just the anticipation of it. That's a service that we provide you.
Thanks to Nick Larandis, who composed our theme song. This week, we will be putting up our December schedule. Check the social feeds, and then it'll get added to the website. It is as follows: Palimpsest by Catherine M. Vellante. Never Tell by Selena Montgomery, aka Stacey Abrams, from the Georgia elections.
From Georgia.
From
yeah.
Georgia. The Big Sleep by Raymond Chandler, and Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell. We will, of course, be doing a bonus episode. Andrew, do you want to read the title of our, do you remember the title of our bonus episode?
'Twas the Knife Before Christmas.
Yeah, by Jacqueline Frost. I can't wait to share that with everyone.
Can I just tease Palimpsest for you for just a real quick?
Please, why not? It's next week's episode. Yeah.
Palimpsest, where two people meet on a train and they both love trains so much, and one guy has written a book about trains, and they get so horny about trains on the train that they have sex on the train.
Yes.
So I don't know what that's about.
I'm into it.
It's a strong first chapter.
Gotta come back next week.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast. Until we talk to you next week, please try to be happy.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.